Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's July 16th. Currently 62 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 64 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Park City. Yeah, another gorgeous day or kickoff, at least, to your Tuesday. We have some smoke and haze we're dealing with as wildfires continue to burn around the region. Otherwise, air quality isn't too bad. Overall, 85 degrees today for the high in Park City. We do have partly cloudy skies this afternoon with a slight chance of a stray shower or storm. Not looking too significant today or tomorrow. Temperatures warm up a little bit into Wednesday. Overnight lows in the upper 50s with highs near 89 on Wednesday. And we're going to hover in those mid to upper 80s throughout the remainder of the week and even throughout the weekend. So high pressure situated over the corner area right now will shift a little further west, essentially right over top of the Beehive State throughout the remainder of the week and the weekend. So it'll keep our weather pattern pretty consistent. Much change day to day. Now, monsoon moisture still rotating around the ridge. We'll keep that slight chance of afternoon showers and storms in the mix as well, with the best chances across central and southern Utah. So it's only about a 10 to 20% chance for areas of Park City. So highs on Thursday near 87, near 90 or so on Friday. And then we're going to continue to see those mid to upper 80s, as I mentioned, into early next week, with 88 on Sunday and on Monday. Partly cloudy skies Monday next week. Heber looking at 92 today, 95 tomorrow with quite a bit of sunshine. Minimal threat, I think, for storms for today, tomorrow, but a better chance on Thursday. 94 on Thursday for the high in Heber with those mid-90s into the weekend, and 95 partly cloudy on Monday next week.
All right, Nate, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybell with a preview of this week's county council meeting. Later on, Kimball Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken will be joined by Curator Nancy Stokes. They'll have more details on their current exhibit, In the Shadow of the Wall. And also from Recycle Utah, Carolyn Wara, Jim Bedell. They'll have details on the upcoming 100-mile meal, as well as a planned two-week closure of Recycle Utah in August. Taking a look at some local news now, more Utahns are getting out on the ski slopes according to data from this past ski and ride season. KPCW's Parkamela Testa has details.
Ski Utah President and CEO Nathan Rafferty said one new trend is apparent when looking at visitor data for the state's 15 ski resorts from winter 2023-24.
We have seen just this last year an uptick in local visits. And I think a lot of that has, well, there are two reasons. A lot of people are moving here to Utah because of the great recreational opportunities and then the sale of these big multi-area passes. If you've got a pass in your pocket that's good for multiple ski areas, you're going to ski a ton.
Rafferty didn't provide exact numbers on how many Utahns are visiting local resorts. He said California and New York remain the largest out-of-state markets.
Texas has inched up over the last few years, and in the last decade, actually since the big multi-area pass have come online, Denver never was on our radar. And we see an increasing number of green license plates showing up in our state skiing real snow.
In total, Ski Utah reported 6.7 million skier visits this past season, which ranks second all time. It's about a 5% dip from the 2022-23 winter, which saw historic snow levels and a record 7.1 million skier visits in Utah. A visit is recorded every time an individual uses a lift ticket or pass. Ski Utah has access to loads of data thanks to the Radio Frequency Identification Technology, or RFID, in ski passes. RFID tags track the movement of skiers and riders between lifts and resorts. Rafferty will be part of the Utah delegation going to Paris next week, where Salt Lake City expects to be named host of the 2034 Winter Olympics. He said he plans to use the trip to network and learn from another Olympic host city.
We're only going to have so many opportunities to understand how future Olympic host cities continue to maintain tourism during that Olympic year. And we saw a huge drop here in 2002. Now, 2034 is the landscape is just totally different. Our city's changed, our state has changed so much, but it's something that we're very focused on, is making sure that that's still going to be a successful season.
Rafferty will also market Utah skiing destinations in New York City later this year as part of an annual meetup with travel writers and influencers. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets on Wednesday starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview, I have Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with a discussion on current fire restrictions and the potential for additional restrictions. That's item number 4 on the agenda. We saw 2 small fires at the Heber Airport last week. We've got continued hot, dry weather. What changes would the council like to see?
Well, this is coming from the fire district. The fire chief and our fire warden are recommending that we go along with, actually the state has enacted some more strict regulations. Previously, we enacted a work restriction in what's called the wildland urban interface area. These are kind of the wooded hills around the Heber Valley and most of the county. But the state's restrictions actually will restrict fireworks in the valley floor itself. And so this would be basically everywhere in the county that's not incorporated, where the cities control their own firework restrictions.
And it's more difficult, is my understanding, for counties to put these restrictions in place. So what needed to happen for you to be able to do that?
Well, because the state has already enacted them, we're not certain that the county does need to take any additional action. It's possible that we may just pass some advisory recommendations along the same lines of making sure that people are being safe and not putting our property and lives in peril just to celebrate.
Yeah, now have the municipalities, Heber and Midway, also put in those restrictions?
Yes, I think to varying degrees they have, and it's possible that and really the impetus is making sure that these types of restrictions are in place and communicated prior to the celebrations on the 24th.
Okay, and what are you asking of residents? What kind of precautions before Pioneer Day?
So some of the things that we will talk about on Wednesday is whether or not we are restricting burns outside of improved fire pits. And I think those would be in addition to the firework restrictions. But ultimately, we just want people to make sure they're being safe. It is very hot and dry conditions, and these are the types of things where a fire can really run away and cause a lot of damage.
Sure. So where can people get the most up-to-date information about any fire restrictions in the county?
So on the Wasatch County Fire District's website, that's wasatchcountyfire.org.
All right. Later on, an update on the possible awarding of a request for proposals for the county administration building. Again, this is a remodel, not an entirely new building.
No, this will be an entirely new building. So we are doing a remodel and an extension to our county courthouse building, but we are also pursuing a new construction of an administration building. The nice thing is that previous councils and the previous county manager have done a good job of saving a lot of cash so that we will be able to finance this without having to go back, both the courthouse and the new administration building, without having to go back to taxpayers for additional funds.
So where's the new administration building getting built?
The location that we've selected is Midway Lane. This is Highway 113 that connects Heber City to Midway City, and Southfield Road on that intersection. This is near to where the new high school is going in on that southwest side. So the county already owns property on what is the west side of Southfield Road, directly across from Southfield Park.
And what will be done with the current administration building?
We've been in talks with Heber City actually for a few years to sell the building to them. That's not, happened yet, and we aren't under contract or anything, but that's kind of the direction that we've been heading. Heber City is looking to revitalize their downtown, and they view this piece of land as part of that initiative.
All right. And can you put some comparisons to us? I mean, what you have now to what you're going to be building in terms of square footage?
I don't know the square footage of our existing facilities right now, but part of it is we have used every nook and cranny of our existing facilities to make sure that we're taking advantage of the space we currently have. But there have been many times in the past where we've had to hold off on hiring people because we don't have space for them. So the new building will actually consolidate staff from across 3 other buildings. And so that those buildings will then gain the space. This will be staff coming out of like where our health department is, so that the health department, behavioral health offices, will be able to have some additional space, and that we will consolidate all of the county elected officials, as well as our administrative support, In the new building. So we're looking at something in the 40 to 60,000 square foot range.
All right. And given the growth of the county, are you sure that you're building this big enough? I mean, you don't want to have to do this twice. As you know, things are only getting more expensive.
Yeah, that is a very critical item that we've tasked the architects to coming up with creative solutions to how we can prepare for the future. There are, I think, a number of things that we can do. One, planning for where future additions will be. And two is specifically designing the space so that it can be adjusted and changed as we go forward. Some of the things we'll also be doing is shifting to more flexible, open design so that as departments grow and shrink, and we have had departments grow and shrink over the last 20 years or so, that we have the ability to basically reprogram some of those spaces to make sure that we're doing that. I think another major advantage of the new facility is if you've been in our current administration building, we have 7 front desks in a relatively small building, and we're looking to consolidate those to just 3 or 4 in the new one so that the public has an easier job of interacting with us and doesn't have to know where exactly to go to get the things done that they need to.
All right. Total project cost?
So the original estimate from the needs assessment that we completed a little over a year ago was about $30 million. I imagine that since then, the cost has gone up. So we are working with the architects now to get a final cost, but we don't, or at least closer to a final cost, but we don't have those numbers just yet.
All right. And you say that you have been setting aside money for this. I mean, will you have all $30+ million?
We are working on a few. There are a number of funding sources that lie in current county coffers that we're looking to allocate towards this. One of them we talked about at our interlocal meeting last week is our corridor preservation funds that we can reimburse the county some of those. So I think we already have about $20 million in cash, and we are looking to accumulate the rest. It's possible that we might have to identify other future funding as we go forward, but thankfully we're in a position where we're able to take on these things and again not have to go back to taxpayers, largely because of the economic activity that's taking place around the Deer Valley area.
Sure. I mean, could you just bond for it?
Yeah, we could. And I think that's certainly a discussion we'll have once we know what the final number is. If we did bond for it, it wouldn't be through a general obligation bond or anything like that, because I think we don't feel like that's necessary. It would probably be somewhere in the range of like a smaller bond that would be through a lease revenue bond that we could just pay back with those revenues from these sales taxes that we're generating from some of these other more rapidly growing areas.
Okay. And what's the planned construction timeline on this?
We're hoping to begin next year. It's to be annexed into Heber City, so we're working with them on that. And hopefully by next summer, it'll begin under construction, and it'll be somewhere in the range of an 18-month build. So by the end of 2026, I think, is when the building should be close to complete.
All right. Agenda item number 7, a discussion on the interlocal UDOT letter. All Wasatch County entities are working on this letter about the Heber Valley Corridor, also what we commonly call the bypass road. So can you just quickly recap last week's interlocal discussion?
Yeah, so there was a subset of elected officials across 4 different entities. That's Heber City, Midway City, Wasatch County, and the Wasatch County School District. They had representatives from each of those bodies kind of come together and work on this letter. It basically outlines some priorities that we feel are, that those representatives feel are kind of universal across all of these entities about making sure that the bypass preserves our rural character and minimizes its impacts while optimizing kind of the benefit to the Heber City area. I think there was a fair amount of discussion about, you know, the specifics of the language of the letter and a process with which we might either amend or approve it. And so I think that's going to be the content of our conversation on Wednesday, is how the Wasatch County Council feels about the letter, if they want to recommend changes or other things. And I think it's useful to point out that Wasatch County passed a resolution several weeks ago now, kind of stating our support of the bypass. And I think this is in the same vein of expressing support and wanting to move forward but doing it in a way that minimizes its impacts.
Sure, and I understand many feel that the North Fields are the prize of Wasatch County, but are emotions clouding what makes the most sense to build the best design that can take this bypass through the North Fields into the future as opposed to short term?
Well, I think there's a number of considerations there in that there are things that we feel like can be done today that would be universally supported that do minimize those impacts to the North Fields, like a route that is closer to Heber City that doesn't necessarily preclude future action when the time warrants it. A lot of the concern is about what's happening in kind of the North Highway 40, North Heber City section of the town. And currently there's just only some of that is building out, and that there are opportunities to kind of deal with those issues in the future. I think the other aspect is that what is best or what best prepares us for the future could be a matter of debate and has been debated for a long time of how do we preserve the North Fields with a road through it. And there are a lot of opinions about the best ways to possibly do that. Or are there things that you could do to North Highway 40 that still get close to the same travel times without having those impacts on that other rural property?
Okay, so are all of the entities coming together in this, or do we have something preventing everyone from coming to an agreement?
So the discussion last week was getting that letter to be approved by each of the entities. I think there were, you know, Midway City and others expressed a desire to maybe amend or work on that. And so that's where all of the entities were going to kind of take it back, talk with their entire bodies, and get the feel of, are we close? Are we not? Do we need to make changes? And if so, do we need to convene a meeting to work through those changes? So it's a work in progress, and I expect it will be for the next little while.
All right. And what about UDOT? I mean, where are they? Do they have more plans on what's going to happen here, or when do you expect to hear an update?
We've been hoping to hear an update, you know, for the last several weeks. I believe that they're still doing some technical analysis on impacts of conservation easements and other aspects of the project. So we have not heard anything for the last couple months, but I know that they are working with the NRCS and other entities to identify a path forward.
All right. There will be a public hearing on Wednesday's agenda to update the Wasatch County Trails Master Plan. Can you tell us what this is about?
This is really just updating the map that we have. Right now, we have a good map, and there are just sections of it that have been built out. So by correcting those sections to more accurately reflect what is currently built and instead of what is just proposed, will help better communicate the current status of our trails and identify those opportunities as we go forward to make sure that we are filling out our trail network system.
Okay. Any idea what could change for trail users?
I don't expect there will be a lot of change. The county has been consistently committed to a robust trail system, and I think you'll see that continuing going forward. This will just be a technical adoption that will make sure that everyone has clearly been communicated what the status of our trail system is and where we see it going forward. But again, I don't see a whole lot of changes to it.
All right. Let's see. The council approved July 3rd the 0.3% increase in the transit sales tax. So when does this sales tax increase go into effect?
So the process with the tax commission is that we have provided them a copy of that resolution and that they then take 90 days to implement it. And following that, the beginning of the next quarter will start. And that timeline means that it will be in January of 2025 when the sales tax goes into effect, which makes it so that we have this opportunity for the remainder of this year as we work on our 2025 budget. We can adequately analyze and prepare for how to specifically use those funds. We've talked about over the last 7 months a number of ideas and priorities along funding. What the council adopted was 25% of those sales taxes will go to public safety. That'll be about $900,000. I had a meeting yesterday with the sheriff to kind of work with him on developing the funding priorities that he has for those public safety funds. And then I think we have a strong sense of where we're headed with transit, but it is enhancing the service that we have and paying for the current level of service and seeing what opportunities are kind of best suited to make sure that we are continuing to deliver quality transit in conjunction with High Valley Transit and their staff.
Yeah. Now, for those residents that don't like to see their taxes go up, what do you tell them?
I think this is a unique opportunity. Our sales tax in the county is currently paid for about half of it by non-county residents. As the Deer Valley area develops, this is going to be a major funding source, and ultimately they are going to help us significantly pay for it. So this is a really big bang for your buck. A 0.3 sales tax is only 3 cents on a $10 purchase or 30 cents on a $100 purchase. It doesn't apply to gas or groceries. It doesn't apply to pharmacy bills or other services. So we hope that this doesn't adversely impact our residents too much, and we actually get a really good return on this investment. We also feel like transit is one piece of the puzzle of how we preserve our quality of life. If you ask anybody in the Heber Valley, traffic is already a problem. And with the amount of growth that we see coming towards us, it's going to continue to be a problem. And by having a transit solution that is viable and attractive to people to use, gives us the opportunity to help impact those traffic changes over time.
Yeah. That 50% that you say that will come from outside the community, not residents themselves, how do you know that?
So that's based on the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute's data on tourism. They produce an annual report, and then also combining that with the tax commission's revenue identification. So it's actually not too difficult, and some would say that that's actually an underestimate. I calculated that based on these reliable sources, but there are other sources like credit card transaction data that suggest that maybe it's even higher than that.
Okay. Does Wasatch County have a representative on the High Valley Transit Board of Directors?
We do have an ex officio member. Mark Nelson on our county council is that ever since we began down this path of embarking on transit, the intent has been to fully annex into High Valley Transit and get a full member on that board. But right now it's just that kind of advisory position, and High Valley Transit has been very responsive to our requests for data and information and working with us on as we serve the public.
All right, so what does it take to be annexed by the district?
So High Valley Transit established the criteria when they kind of made some of their changes from the Snyderville Basin District. What some of those things are that the county, Wasatch County, needs to adopt at least 3 transit sales taxes. So we have just adopted our second. In order to, by the current rules, in order to fully annex, we would need to adopt a third and then begin that annexation process, which would be a resolution, I believe, passed by the county council that would then kind of initiate a process in which people could express opposition to that if they wanted to. Otherwise, the county could be incorporated. I expect, I don't know exactly when we would adopt that third transit sales tax, and that will be up to the county council if and when we do that. But I believe that's the path that we've been heading on for the last few years.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Dustin?
Not this morning.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dustin Graybow is the manager of Wasatch County. Well, the Kimball Arts Center has a new exhibition, and in the studio with details, I have executive director of the Kimball, Aldi Milliken, along with curator Nancy Stokes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nancy, maybe we'll start with you and just have us tell about what you've got up on the walls of the Kimball.
Yeah, so we have an exhibition called In the Shadow of the Wall. It's a group exhibition with 15 artists from around the country and from Mexico exploring the borderlands and the migrant experience and bringing more nuance and depth to that conversation.
Okay, and Ollie, why was this something you thought belongs in the Kimball?
I mean, we think immigration is kind of a hot topic right now. It's something that I think that we're grappling with in the United States politically, socially, and from the humanitarian perspective. And we just wanted to elevate the stories of people that are in our country, that are providing, are an incredible resource, both culturally and socially. And around the country, around the globe, a lot of other countries are grappling with this issue. So I was in Venice this summer. There is an exhibition called Immigrants Are Everywhere. And it was a, you know, it was, there was probably 200 or 300 artists in that in that exhibition. And then of course I think you were playing Hamilton earlier this morning. That also had a quote about how vital immigrants are to this country. And so culturally, these dialogues are happening and they're very present in our minds.
Yeah, so I mean, the wall we're talking about is the border wall between the U.S. and Mexico.
Exactly.
What's the shadow?
It's the impact, that's the short-term, the long-term impact that this border wall has on people, on cultures, on society, on both sides of the wall.
And it's also kind of a very poetic way of illuminating the conversation. I think a lot of us are afraid to have these conversations, and the Kimball Arts Center as an educational institution has an opportunity to have difficult conversations that are not threatening. I mean, we can allow people to be who they are. They have their perspectives. We're not telling people to think one way on this issue at all. We're just asking questions about, you know, what is a border? What is the role of a border? Why have borders changed over time? I mean, what are the impacts of borders? And what are those impacts on families, communities, ecosystems? And so it's really just a way for us to have the dialogue. And like we said, it's sort of a really interesting cultural moment at this time.
Yeah, and art is such a powerful way to tell these stories. And so each artist is really bringing, talking about different issues and allowing us to see things, see the world from a different perspective, to ask questions, to learn. Yeah,
we are a relevant cultural organization. I mean, these dialogues are happening across the country, across the world, as we mentioned. And there's no reason why we can't engage our public in this discourse right now. We have elevated conversations. And there are a lot of people that are in the shadows in Park City and in Summit County. So let's bring them out of the shadows. Let's illuminate those voices. And let's elevate those voices and show the humanity behind the conversations. Let's work towards equity and diversity in a really authentic way, in a cultural way that'll make an impact for everybody.
Yeah, well, I love that you use the word poetic, because that's kind of the artist in you. Yeah. But it's a very divisive political issue.
It is, and you know, Nancy's title is amazing, I think, because it really shows us going to the light. We're uncovering and unpacking the shadows. And like we said, we're not about a position. We're about educating and having the dialogue. And the more of those conversations that we can have, the more we can connect to people and see people, I think the better we're gonna actually be as a society. And you know, a lot of the conversations that we're having across the Summit County right now is about connection and is about humanity. And so the Kimball is right at the forefront of those dialogues.
Mm. How difficult of an exhibit was it to install? It looks like the map there in the main gallery as you walk in is what, 3D?
Yeah, we have a great diversity of work in the show, and yep, definitely some of the installations and larger pieces were intensive installs and lots of fun to come together and make happen. But
Our team, it does such a great job. Nancy and her team, the installation team, you know, really are kind of reaching, you know, we have 2 weeks, which is basically means we have about 5 days to turn around and install a new show. So we have 3 days to take one down, 5 days to put one up. And there are massive installations in this exhibition. And you know, we want to give our community the best. And so part of creating an exhibition is finding the best work that fit into the thematic exhibitions that we're trying to create.
All right. And you mentioned the artists. There's 15 of them. They're all American, or they're half American, half Mexican?
Yeah, it's a mix of artists who, some who are American, some, many of them grew up in Mexico, and some still live there. Some have moved to the U.S. over time.
Yeah, and so the, yeah.
So yeah, each bringing a different perspective and life.
Yeah, it's less on, in a way, it's less, I mean, obviously this with this topic, we are focusing heavily on our relationship to South America, Central America, and Mexico, not a singular way to look at this. It's really more about the humanity, and these artists are selected to elevate their voices to share with our thematic program.
All right. Talk to us a little about some of the upcoming events that you've got to coordinate with this exhibit.
Yeah, we have some amazing programs coming up, and we wanted to highlight two that are coming up just in the next couple of weeks. On Saturday, we have a live performance by Jorge Rojas. He's an incredible local artist doing a performance about migration and identity. That'll be Saturday at 6 o'clock. And I just want to point out that space is limited for that. So please go onto our website and RSVP so you can save your spot for that. And then the second one is a screening of a really amazing film called Border South. We'll be screening that at the Jim Santee Auditorium on Thursday, July 25th at 5:30, and that ties into one of the installations that we have at the Kimball right now called Hostile Terrain, and it highlights the work of Jason De Leon, an anthropologist who has spent a lot of time exploring the U.S.-Mexico borderlands.
All right. Admission to that is
it's free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. The exhibit is up till when?
Through August 18th.
Okay. And can you tell us what you got planned for after that then?
So we actually have an exhibition. Actually, I am jumping into the curatorial ring for a change here. Nancy's been doing all the work really for the last 4 years, and so I'm going to be curating an exhibition and a collaboration with a solo artist named Carl Handel, who's an LA-based artist who actually does all his work, which is graphite or pencil on paper, but he makes these large installations and large pieces, and the precision of his work, the labor of his work is really quite interesting. He's an artist that I worked with back in 2006 and 7 in Sweden when I lived there. So we're kind of revisiting our relationship and working on that exhibition. So that's going to be called Less Bad. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of content that is also sort of happening in a global or national landscape or political landscape right now. So that's going to be happening. That'll be opening on the 30th of August. And so I'm looking forward to that. That's something that's going to be quite special for us.
Okay. I'm going to change subjects, but we've got now the Bonanza Small Area plan done. What about the 5-acre plan? Is that complete?
Yeah, so that's actually great that you mentioned that, Leslie, because we've been having, sitting down with the city and having negotiations with the city. Actually, we met with the mayor and council yesterday, the council liaison, and we're continuing the conversation. I would say we're 90% done. The Kimball has articulated its sort of needs for a piece of property and also a relationship to town in a way, because the city has certain parameters about a collaboration that they do with a nonprofit. So what is the public benefit of the Kimball Arts Center? And how can the city facilitate our position on that property? Where do we want to be on that property? What is, you know, height variances? All this sort of boring stuff that people don't think about, but the stuff that's really important about our relationship. I can say that we're having a really good dialogue with the city, and I'm quite positive. You know, we don't have a signed contract. That's what we're reaching for. But we have had some really positive, dialogues with the city. Lot of community support, and we'd like to thank our community for telling the city and city council that art was important. I mean, someone arts and Park City Arts Council, Jocelyn Scudder and their team and our team, and then all the other art advocates out there that have said, hey, we want to see a home for the Kimball Arts Center. And now we're right at that moment where, hey, this actually might happen. It's going to happen.
It seems like the wave of the future with Park City has been public-private partnerships, but it sounds like you want to own the 1 acre.
Actually, I think in a perfect world, we would lease the acre from the city. The city would maintain ownership. That's more of a common model across municipalities across the country. So that lease agreement would actually be a way the city could support the Kimball, and then we would maintain, you know, some kind of contract that would say if something happened to the city, you know, I mean, that's not going to happen, but we want to have sort of a contractual relationship, but a lease is actually better for us.
So is that where you're headed?
And that is where we're heading. And the Homestake property was, was a lease agreement through the affordable housing. And, you know, there was obviously very clear, common, good public benefit with affordable housing. We've talked a lot about affordable housing, but what is the common good of the Kimball Arts Center? And do we also, or should we also, have the same support from the city when it comes to our public benefit? How do we serve? I mean, we are a local organization. We are in all the schools, and we educate our community. We work with our community. And so we really are, in my opinion, an organization that supports public benefits, and we'll be able to fulfill that clause. But we still need to sort of have that dialogue with the city.
Yeah, so what consultants are you working with?
Right now, we are not working with consultants. We're working with our attorney, obviously, and our board team. We've got a great board team that are committed to realizing this project. You know, the Kimball board has been working on this for 10 plus years. And so, you know, we're at that moment now. We've learned a lot in the last 10 years about what we need to really focus on. Focus on the contract first, and then we can focus on what we're going to achieve as a community. What is the Kimball and the future of the Kimball going to look like? And that's going to require everybody to participate.
So do you even have any architectural drawings at this point?
We do not at this time. We more have master planning ideas, and you know, this isn't in the phasing of a project like this, and developers out there know this better than I do, but you actually should get your contracts and your agreements first, and then you start thinking about what do we want to achieve, and then we'll do our own public benefit analysis. We're going to engage the community. You know, do you want a cafe in there? I mean, the answer is yes to me. I miss Ritual Coffee and spend a lot of time there, so I want to see us having resources, mixed use sort of opportunities for people that are facilitating our mission, you know, supporting our mission for art, but also providing spaces, open spaces, dialogue spaces, sitting spaces, working spaces, creative spaces for artists.
Yeah, well, this was before your time, but at one point down at the Heber Avenue location, we saw drawings for, you know, like a 68-foot tall building. You will have some height increases, though, if you provide that benefit?
We will. That opportunity is there. Obviously, it's part of our discussions. You know, we're looking to achieve, you know, a reasonable building in scope for our mission. So we're not going to come out with 68. I can guarantee you there won't be 68-foot buildings. We're cognizant of the height variances and everything. You know, we spent a lot of time thinking about this, but really we want to achieve a building for our mission. We need a sustainable home.
And best case scenario in terms of a construction timeline?
I think of it more as achieving that home. And so the timing, obviously we want to achieve this as soon as possible, but we want to do it as reasonably as possible. We do not want to get ahead of ourselves. We've got community members to activate. We've got donors to activate. We've got board members to activate. We've got artists and our creative class to activate. So, and of course we have to go through the planning process, and we have to work with all those, with the planning department and planning commission. So, you know, I always say 5 years. Anyone asks me that question, I say 5 years. It was 5 years 5 years ago, and it's 5 years today. But I would say, actually, more reasonably, between 3 and 5 years, we're going to really start making something happen.
And certainly you have money in the bank from the sale of the Kimball on Main Street in Heber. Enough to build a new building, or are you going to have to do a capital campaign?
We are definitely going to do a capital campaign. I mean, there's two areas of the capital campaign that are really important. Obviously, there's the money for the building. We want to make sure we build a sustainable building that is green, that achieves our mission, that has spaces for the public. But we also need to build an endowment. And so the endowment piece is really important. We know there's a lot of people out there that support the arts, that have the capacity, and we are looking forward to sitting down with them and and partnering with them to make this project happen.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Aldi and Nancy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Executive Director of the Kimball Arts Center, Aldi Milliken, along with Curator of the exhibit, Nancy Stokes. Well, members of the local nonprofit Youth Sports Alliance are traveling to Paris next week as Utah awaits an official announcement about hosting the 2034 Winter Olympics. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
A delegation of elected officials, athletes, and bid organizers are heading to Paris next week, where the International Olympic Committee will vote on whether the Games should return to Salt Lake City in 2034. The bid team is bringing along several Parkites, including Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher.
Catherine Rainey Norman, who's the chair of the bid committee, reached out and said, you know, we really love what's happening at the Youth Sports Alliance. We really love to have some of your athletes and have you accompany us for the bid to sort of share this message about what an Olympic Games can do for a community, not just for those 17 days of the Games, but for a legacy going forward.
The nonprofit Youth Sports Alliance, which runs a variety of after-school recreation programs for youth in the Wasatch Back, was born out of the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City. Fisher will be joined in France by several YSA athletes, including luge athlete Orson Colby.
He's 18. He's part of the Wasatch Luge Club. He discovered luge while he was working on a Boy Scout merit badge. But he's part of that legacy of the 2002 Games. He trains with the Wasatch Luge Club that we support through Jan's Winter Welcome, and we have supported him with scholarships from the Stein Erickson Endowment. He competed just this last year at the Youth Olympic Games and the Junior World Championship.
Figure skater Kate Presgrove will also be a part of the delegation.
She's 16. She's a member of the Figure Skating Club of Park City. She is a really special young athlete here in the community. She works incredibly hard, and she has also been a recipient of the Stein Erickson Endowment scholarships from the Youth Sports Alliance for years. So exciting to just have those athletes coming with us.
Tom Kelly, who is spokesman for Utah's 2034 bid, said they're also bringing private donors to Paris.
We're entirely privately funded, and we will fund the games in 2034 entirely from private sources. So we are taking a very large donor group over as well. And these are the people who have helped to support the bid. The bid cost was $4 million, which is actually, as far as bid goes, is probably one of the lowest ever.
The pivotal moment will come on July 24th at 3:30 a.m. local time, when IOC members are expected to officially vote in Paris to award the 2034 Winter Olympics to Salt Lake City. Kelly said there will be a live watch party that night at the Salt Lake City and County Building in Washington Square. Park City is planning a separate celebration at Utah Olympic Park at 4 p.m. on July 24th, which is also Pioneer Day. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, there's been an uptick in human-bear interactions around Park City over the past few days. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that one bear was hit and killed on Interstate 80 yesterday morning.
Morgan resident Rod Myers says he passed a black bear shortly after it had been hit on I-80 in northern Summit County.
The vehicle that hit it was gone.
Utah Highway Patrol Sergeant Chris Bishop says the incident occurred near mile marker 153 close to Wanship, but the Division of Wildlife Resources responded. It's not considered criminal if vehicles accidentally hit wildlife, DWR Lieutenant Chad Bettridge says, quote, as long as it isn't intentional, there would not be charges. Myers says a truck with yellow flashing lights had pulled the dead bear to the side of the road and was cleaning up the scene.
You see everything else but, and I have seen moose as well. But a bear is rare, and it was small. It wasn't a very large animal.
There have been a series of bear sightings in the Park City area recently. Colony resident Josh Tarter sent KPCW a video of a black bear outside his home over the weekend near the Flatiron Lift. The DWR says Utah only has black bears, not grizzlies, which are more aggressive. Still, humans should take measures to avoid potentially dangerous confrontations with black bears. Those include packing away food and scented items when outdoors and keeping cooking areas clean. According to the DWR, everything from bird feeders to compost piles, beehives, pets, pet food, and barbecue grills can attract bears to your home. Anyone who encounters a black bear should not play dead or flee. Instead, stand your ground, make yourself bigger, and make noise before backing away slowly. If it does attack, DWR recommends fighting back, as people have successfully defended themselves from black bears. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Reservations are being taken for Recycle Utah's annual 100-mile meal. In the studio with details, I have Recycle Utah Executive Director Carolyn Warr, along with board member Jim Bedell. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
We were hoping we were going to be joined by the chef of putting all of this together, Alex, with Park City Mountain, but maybe just start with some details in terms of when, where, how much?
Oh, yeah. 100-mile meal is Recycle's Utah biggest fundraiser.
And this year, the event is at the Red Pine Lodge at Canyons Village on August 17th. And I suspect Alex and his team are actually working quite diligently right now on the menu, because we've been in touch with many local ranchers and farmers and pretty much have a sense of what ingredients are going to be available now. And the Vail chef's team are the people who put that all together into a wonderful meal.
Yeah, well, it used to be that we ate local, we ate seasonal, and, you know, now we get oranges in the summer and asparagus in the fall, but that's not the way it used to be. And the whole idea behind this meal is that everything comes from within a 100-mile radius.
Yep. Aunt Brian's bars for the food are sourced within 20 miles of Resetter Luta.
Yep, exactly. So as you said, Leslie, all the ingredients are sourced within 100 miles of our site.
Okay, this is something I think sells out, so people, if they're interested, should get tickets.
Yep, we do sell out each year, or if you're interested, buy your tickets soon.
Okay, and that can be done on the website?
Oh, yeah. Tickets for sale, our website, recycleutah.org.
Okay, also wanted to ask you about, we had heard that Recycle Utah could be closing down for 2 full weeks next month?
Yes, correct. We've been on notice for quite some time now that the Engine House project, which is right at the end of our property, needs to run a sewer connection from that project to the sewer line. And as a result, they need to dig up the road that runs right through our property. So we are awaiting final notice as to when they'll start that. We hope sometime during August, because that tends to be a good time for us to be closed for 2 weeks. And it'll be an interesting challenge, because we've never been in a situation, as far as I know, Carolyn may know otherwise, where we've had to close for that period of time. So we're going to be thinking a lot about the logistics that are required, both on our end and suggestions for users in terms of holding off for a few weeks before they bring us materials.
All right. And I was going to mention, because it seems like you only take off a handful of days that you actually close. So this is big to think that you'd be closed that long of a duration. What do people do with their stuff? Just hold on to it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you would hope that some people, especially residents, might find it easy to just keep things in their garage for another few weeks. It'll be a little bit more challenging for some of the smaller businesses we serve, because they may not have the same storage capacity. So we're going to be sensitive to which of our user base we want to try and accommodate first when we reopen, and hope that there'll be some self-selection where people who can afford to wait a few more days or maybe a week before they come visit us will do so, so that those without the storage capacity can bring their materials to us.
Okay, well, we'll make sure that we get the word out when you guys know what's happening here. Carolyn, I just want to compliment you. I can tell that you've been working hard.
Yes,
your
yeah.
language is getting much better after mm-hmm. your stroke that you suffered early May. Uh-huh. So what's your schedule now?
Therapy in the mornings and Recycle Utah in the afternoons. Yeah.
Okay. So you spend a lot of time in the mornings.
Yeah.
Working hard.
Yep. So.
It's tough.
I know. It's frustrating. Yes.
Yeah. And I think because maybe people don't understand that you have the thoughts in your mind. It just doesn't make, the words just don't come out.
Yes. Yeah. I have the thoughts like, ooh, I'm like lining like, oh, then just left to say like, oh, yes. I'm like, oh, yeah. So I'm dare be no. Okay.
Yeah. And prognosis is good? I mean, because even in a month, I can hear a huge difference.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But prognosis is good.
Okay.
Thank
All right.
you.
Good luck.
Okay,
Jim, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, it's nice to be back here with you, but nothing further from us.
Okay, again, tickets are on sale for that 100-mile meal. It's happening August 17th at the Red Pine Lodge there on the Canyons Village side of things from 4 to 8 p.m. Thanks. Talk to you soon. A Summit County man has been arrested on suspicion of intoxication, that after allegedly swerving into traffic on Bear Hollow Drive on his e-bike. A Summit County Sheriff's deputy saw the man swerving in the Sun Peak neighborhood of Park City at about 11 p.m. Sunday night. According to Chief Deputy Casey Bakes, the deputy says that they saw the biker nearly collide with vehicles multiple times and drift into oncoming traffic before deputies pulled him over. The deputy arrested the man on suspicion of intoxication, which is a Class C misdemeanor. Utah's DUI law is written with motor vehicles in mind, leaving it up to attorneys and judges' interpretations whether to charge cyclists. A Nevada man was convicted of a DUI after biking away from a bar in Vernal back in 2008. Other parts of state law exempt Utahns from having their licenses restricted for committing alcohol and drug-related offenses while cycling. Utah law only penalizes drinking and driving on a Class 2E bike as well. That's the only recognized class of e-bike with a throttle. People on non-electric bikes and other e-bikes may transport open containers. Chief Deputy Bates says the arresting deputy's report does not specify what class of e-bike the man was riding in Sun Peak. As of Monday, the man was no longer in custody and no charges had been filed.